to start if you'll come and teach at the University of Oregon, creating an obvious incentive for those scholars of color, number one, and because I'm willing to pay it, the school doesn't have to pay a penny. I'll come to the president of the University of Oregon and say, I'll pay their salaries for you. You won't have to spend a dime. I will bring 50, 70, 100 new faculty of color to the University of Oregon at no cost to you. Do they take me up on it? Think about that. Ask yourself, how quickly would they take me up on that? Somebody suggested today, well, they would have to form a commission to look into it. And my guess is that the decision would not be favorable. Because if you bring 100 new scholars of color onto this campus, see, it's no longer the same university in the minds of white parents, in the minds of white people in the community, in the minds of most white students. Let's take the other example. Let's say that I, Phil Knight, say it isn't enough to get 100 black and Latino and Asian and Native faculty. I'm going to go out and bring 500, let's say, black kids. And you can go out and you can find it. I mean, you can find 500 more black kids to bring onto this campus. There's no question in my mind about that. You can do it. So let's say Phil Knight decides to do it. He goes out. What's the number now, like 220, 200, a little over 200 or something like that? Let's say he's going to double it. He's going to more than double where it is now. Get 500 new black students and bring them onto this campus. He'll pay to transport them here. He'll pay for them to move their stuff here. He'll pay their tuitions. He'll pay their room and board. He'll pay all of it. Again, no cost to the university, and you just got 500 bright black students to come to this campus, which would more than double the current numbers. Do you think that the community, the administration, the trustees, the president, the administration generally, and many of the white folks in the community of Eugene would be happy to see 500 new black students unloading their stuff on orientation day and during orientation week? See, I have my doubts, and I can't prove this. You know, you're here, and you probably have a better sense of it, but I just have a feeling, and if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, right? But I have a feeling they would not be happy about that. They would not be happy about that, because in fact, whatever commitment they have to diversity, it's this virtual diversity, it's virtual integration, just enough to put the black folks on the website and to put the Latinos on the brochure. So they can send it out, so they can meet their affirmative action goals and not get in trouble with the government, but not that they have to change fundamentally anything, let alone the underlying culture of white domination that exists at this school and any other school. And don't get me wrong, this school's no worse than any other school about the hypocrisy and the inconsistency. This school's no worse about the duplicity, but you're also no better. The good thing is that there is a base, as I've said many times since I've been here, of students and faculty that I've met, and staff, and people who clearly are committed here to creating a different situation at this school. And so I would suggest to you that you take advantage of that foundation, which is, in fact, much stronger here than it is at many schools around the country where I travel. Sometimes I get so depressed when I go places, because I don't see that. I don't see that hope. But last night at that award ceremony, I saw students of color who were clearly ready to forge and willing to forge a different reality at this campus. But you have to be clear about exactly what it is you're fighting for, and you can't be deceived about who's on your side and who's not on your side. Because if they were on your side, it would get done. And you have to recognize they're not, and then you have to figure out how to work against that reality to change that reality. The final thing that we do that I think indicates that we really don't have a clear conception of what it means to be anti-racist if you're white folks, and we're not really committed to equity, is that we exaggerate, and everyone I'm sure has had experiences with this if you're a person of color. White folks tend to exaggerate by a factor of, 10. All the black friends that we have, all the brown friends, all the friends of color generally that we have. You'll hear it all the time. I'm not a racist, I have black friends. I'm not a racist, I have Latino friends. I have friends of all different colors. Very interesting, there were some polls done on this recently, very telling. 1997 Gallup poll found that 3/4 of all white Americans, 75%, say they have close friends who are black. And not just one or two, but many, many close friends who are black. 75% say that. So I pulled out the Census Bureau data, and I pulled out my calculator, and I multiplied the 200 million white people by the 75%, I came out with approximately 146 million people. 146 million whites say they have close friends who are black, and many of them. But there are only 34 million black people in the United States. Now, I was not good at math, as I said, but I know there's a problem with these numbers. Because what that means is, ultimately, that either a lot of white folks are mistaken about just how many close black friends they have, or there are a couple of black folks doing like triple duty, quadruple duty, being friends to like a whole lot of white people. Like, black folks have no time to do anything other than be friends to white people. Those numbers are true. So again, we have a misperception because we live in a society where we accept this virtual equity, this virtual integration, virtual diversity. We see black, you know, most of us, if we're white, see more black people like ER than we will in our neighborhood. And then we assume, when we go see buddy movies, you know, like White Men Can't Jump and Men in Black, you know, white guy, black guy, little conflict, little tension, it all works out in the end. And we go, oh, see, that's fine. Everything has been conquered. And I like that Wesley Snipes. And I like that Denzel Washington. And I love that Oprah. And I love Colin Powell. I'd even vote for him for president. That's a lie. But that's what we say. And then we act as if that indicates our larger goodwill toward ending, you know, the greater system of institutional inequity. But again, it goes back to this notion of accepting only those persons of color that make us feel extremely comfortable. Only those persons of color that won't remind us about racism and will drop it and will leave it alone as an issue. And that, of course, is in fact racist in my opinion, because as I said, it asks people to be accepted only on the terms that you're willing to accept them. So finally, the question then becomes, why would white people care about this? Because if in fact there's institutional inequity that benefits white folks and works to the detriment of people of color, if in fact those numbers about jobs and wages are true, if the discrimination data on housing, for example, 2 million instances of housing discrimination against people of color every year, approximately half the time when blacks and Latinos, for example, seek out housing, either rental or purchase housing, they will be discriminated against, according to 26 different studies in the last quarter century. Even once you control for a lot of other socioeconomic factors, credit factors, et cetera, that discrimination still exists. When you accept that this is true, and when you understand the implications of it, the question then becomes, well, why would I want to change that? Because for white folks, that might sound like a really good deal, you know, so why would I want to change that reality? I would suggest that there are two reasons why we should. One is moral and one is practical. The moral reason, I think, is best explained by use of an analogy, and I used it in the workshop today, and I'll do it again, so for those of you who heard it, I apologize, but I think it's an important one. Let's say, for example, because, you know, you'll hear this argument made by people who will say, well, I'm not responsible for this institutional inequity, you know. I didn't own slaves. I didn't steal Mexico. You know, I did not slaughter Native people. I did not pass the Chinese Exclusion Act. I didn't do any of this. I didn't maintain Jim Crow laws. So it's not my problem. And whatever's happened, you know, is sort of beyond my purview. It's not something I should be made responsible for. And the analogy that I use to sort of make the point as to how flawed that reasoning is, you know, assuming, for example, your father were to rob a bank and get away with about $2 million worth of somebody else's money. And with that money, would go out and buy you all kinds of new stuff. Go out and buy you and your family a new house, buy you a couple new cars, buy you some new clothes, new video games, new televisions, new stereo equipment, whatever. And eventually gets caught, maybe a year later, 2 years later. And of course, they take him away to jail because he's committed a crime. And they're also going to want the stuff back, you know, because it was purchased illegally. It was purchased with stolen goods. It is, in effect, stolen property. Now, to that extent, I doubt very seriously that you as the child, you did not steal the stuff. And you might not have even known that your father did it. If you knew he did it, he would be like an accessory. But I'm assuming you didn't even know that he did that. You just thought he won the lottery, got a raise, you know. And you didn't know what had happened. And now you're going to go to the judge and you're going to say, judge, you know, don't take this stuff. Don't repossess this car. Don't come and take it, because I didn't take it. You know, that's a flawed argument, because in effect, you have received stolen goods. You received the benefits of someone else's inequity. You received the benefits of someone else's injustice. You received the benefits of what has gone before. History doesn't end in 1964 with the passing of the Civil Rights Act. So, the suggestion I'm making to you is, yes, it is true that whites in America today are not guilty for the legacy. We're not guilty for the existence of racism, and we should not feel guilty for the existence of institutional racism. But there is a difference between guilt and responsibility. Guilt is backward-looking, responsibility is forward-looking. And I'm suggesting to you that to the extent we inherit the legacy of that past, and it ain't that past. I mean, the Glass-Ceiling Commission report wasn't looking at what things were happening in 1952. They were looking at what was happening in 1992. And other studies in the last 10 years have found, so it's an ongoing process. We really don't even have to talk about what happened 100 years ago to justify targeted programs like affirmative action to create equity. Even what goes on today is enough to justify that. But if we're going to talk about the past, let's at least recognize it has an impact in the present. I'll give you one example that I think makes the point better than any other example that I can make, and it's just one, and I could add to it dozens of others, but I won't. The one is enough. From 1934 to 1962, the program has continued since 1962, but just to look at that 30-year, approximately 28-year period, from 1934 to 1962, this thing that we call the middle class, which is usually a racially coded term for white middle class, we add white to it, when we think middle class, when folks use that terminology in their political candidates, they're talking about white. It's fairly obvious, right? The middle class, particularly the white middle class, was created during that time. You know, before 1934, whether it was because of the Depression or just because we had a huge gap between the rich and the poor, the middle class was much smaller. This creation, this great increase in wealth and opportunity for the so-called middle class happened in the middle of this century, for the most part. Very heavily in the late 1940s, post-war, 1950s. But the interesting thing about this middle class boom was, well, there are two things interesting about it. Number one, it was the result of government policy, at least in part, in fact, in large part. So it wasn't the result of folks just working hard, entrepreneurial capitalists putting their head together and creating wealth. It was the result of a number of government policies that helped to generate wealth, that helped to provide opportunity for housing and for jobs and schooling. The second interesting thing about this period and the creation of the middle class was it was racially restricted. One program in particular will prove the point. It's the Federal Housing Administration Loan Guarantee Program, still in effect. Many of you may get your homes through FHA. The condo that my wife and I live in was an FHA purchase. So it's very common now for first-time homebuyers, young homebuyers, as well as moderate-income homebuyers to use FHA. The program was implemented in 1934, and for the first 30 years of its existence, it was almost exclusively for white people by law and by custom. In other words, what happened was you had the FHA underwriting policy, which actually their underwriting manual said that you could not use FHA underwritten loans, you could not make an FHA underwritten and guaranteed loan in any community that did not maintain racial homogeneity, right? Which is to say that if you were a person of color and you wanted to move into the growing suburbs where the better jobs were, where the better schools were being created, where those opportunities to get away from the very densely packed population of the inner cities were, you couldn't get a loan from the government, underwritten by the government, in those communities unless you were white. And you really couldn't even get them in black communities. You might say, well, maybe they could just get the loan in their own community. No, not really. Because the other part of the FHA policy said that you couldn't give FHA underwritten loans in any neighborhood that was considered a declining or high-risk neighborhood for property values. And every black neighborhood, with the exception of a handful, was considered declining. Which meant if you were a person of color, particularly if you were African American, you could not partake of this program, whereas white folks could. As a result, about 11.5 million, 12 million white families, with approximately 30 to 40 million white people overall, in just this 30-year period, were able to receive housing benefits, homes they otherwise could not afford, and able to then hustle it out to the suburbs, where the jobs increasingly were, and where the better schools were, at a time when people of color could not move from the cities. In other words, the current distribution of where we live, sometimes we act like it's an accident. You know, we talk about black folks are all clustered in the inner city. This population, this is interesting. How did they get so concentrated? This is horrible. As if somehow it was a choice. The people of color who are black, let's say, said, we just want to live in the neighborhoods that are the most crowded, where the buildings are falling apart and the schools are falling apart. They don't pick up the trash but once a week, if then. That's not what happened. It's not as if Latinos just said, you know, we really like the Southwest. And the West Coast, it was their land before it was taken. So there's a reason why certain people are in certain parts of the country and certain neighborhoods and not other neighborhoods. And the reality is that that white middle class opportunity was created in large part as a result of just that one program, in addition to VA loans. And you may say, VA loans? Anyone who's a veteran can get a VA loan. Well, in theory, that's true. But in practice, the VA loans were given out in a highly racially restricted way. Only 2% of VA loans on housing from 1945 to about 1965 went to anyone that wasn't white. And there were a number of reasons. There were restrictive covenants in neighborhoods. There was overt discrimination. So even if you could qualify for a VA loan and you were a black veteran, let's say, or a Latino veteran or an Asian veteran, you still couldn't live in 80% of the neighborhood. So you weren't able to utilize this government program that was available to other people. This program loaned approximately $120 billion worth of home equity to white people in this period, at a time when people of color could not partake of that. That property today is worth approximately $1.5 trillion. And when you add to that the value of the property that wasn't done through FHA, but was done through regular bank loans, but that was off-limits to whites, off-limits to non-whites, conventional loans was obviously racially restrictive just as much, if not more so. When you take all the value of the property that white folks were able to accumulate over that 30-year period when people of color could not, the value of that property today, and keep in mind, this is property that's being handed down to my generation, to my parents' generation. As I speak, as my grandparents' generation dies, they were the ones who got these homes. Those houses get passed down intergenerationally in most instances, right? The value of all that property that was loaned preferentially to white people from 1934 to 62 is now $10 trillion. $10 trillion. Now, I know that's a big number, and we don't really know how to deal with numbers that are that big, so let me put it in perspective for you so you'll know the size of this preferential treatment. We need to understand exactly how much money $10 trillion is, because that's the face of preferential treatment and white advantage in just this one area of housing. $10 trillion, currently being handed down to the baby boom generation and Generation X in the white community, is more than all the outstanding mortgage debt, all the outstanding credit card debt, all the money in all the savings accounts, all the money in all the IRA and 401k retirement plans, all of the annual profits of every manufacturing firm in America, and our entire merchandise trade deficit combined. all of that stuff. This $10 trillion is enough, in other words, to buy everyone's house, pay off everyone's credit card, buy out all of your savings accounts, buy out and pay out your retirement plans, provide the annual profits of every manufacturing company in America, and pay off every single one of our trade competitors. And there'd still be a couple hundred thousand dollars left. Right? That's a significant amount of preference, but we never talk about that. That is my point. That even though you're not responsible for that, and you didn't come out of the womb and, you know, when you were born saying, hey, banks, you know, redline black neighborhoods for me, you know, you didn't come out of the womb demanding this policy, and you're all good people, and you probably would have been against this policy if you'd had a voice at the time it was created. But you weren't here. Other people were here. They stood by and let this happen, and you now reap the benefits of it. And therefore, you are, in fact, responsible to address that legacy, that inequity. And to say that it's not your responsibility is to become complicit in the maintenance of that inequity. It makes you then just as guilty as those who did it, once you know about it and say, oh, well, it's not my problem. Right? The reality is we love to take credit for the things that our forefathers did. Right? That's what the 4th of July is. We love to talk about all the great things that our forefathers did. We love to take credit for them. We love to celebrate them. We love to praise them. We just don't want to deal with the bad stuff. We want to deal with the credits and not the debits, you know. But if you inherit a company, if you're lucky enough, you know, to inherit a company 5-10 years from now, you're not going to be able to go in and say, well, I'm going to take advantage of all the assets on the books, but I'm not paying any of my bills because I didn't run up the debt. I mean, you don't get that option. Those debts get transferred until they are wiped clean. There's more than just a moral issue. There's also a practical issue. Two things in particular that are critical to know. The reality is that, even though you might not know it by looking around the University of Oregon, you might not know it by looking around Eugene, the reality is that, and it will happen here as well, certainly in this part of Oregon and throughout the country, the demographic face of this nation is changing. We all are aware of this. So on a practical level, even if you do not buy the moral obligation to create equity structures, even if you do not buy the moral obligation to rectify housing inequity, to rectify educational inequity, to rectify job and wage inequity, there's a practical issue. By the year 2030, 85% of the entering workforce in this country will be either people of color, male and female, or white women. That is to say, only about 15% of the entering workforce, coming into the workforce for the first time, are going to be white guys, which by definition means there won't be enough white guys to run everything the way that white guys have had a preponderance of the best positions throughout history, which means that unless we deal with the structures of sexism and structures of racism and exclusion and inequity and glass ceilings on the basis of race and sex, we are going to all face very dire futures economically in this country and socially and culturally in this country. There will not be enough talented and qualified white men to run things, so we have to make sure that there are equity structures in place. The same is true for our educational facilities. Half the children in the nation's classrooms by 2030 are going to be students of color, which means if we do not have equity structures in place, if we continue to disproportionately track black and Latino students, for example, and Native American students and various subgroups within the Asian Pacific American community into the remedial and the standard level classes, which happens all over this country with absolutely no logical basis in terms of merit and ability whatsoever, while we disproportionately track white students into the advanced placement and the honors courses, even as people of color are becoming half or more of our nation's students, how are we going to be preparing our country as a whole, not just those individual students, but our nation as a whole, for a very different reality socially and economically in the 21st century? It's really a matter of practical survival. Let me point out, I hate to make this pitch. Right? I would rather stand up here in this whole church. I'd rather just stand up here and talk about the moral obligation, but I know full well that I can't always do that, because there are folks for whom they need to know what's in it for them, and that's fine. I'm more than willing to give you both ends of that argument, that there's both a moral and a practical obligation. There's one other element of the practical obligation, in that discrimination and inequity does, in fact, have a negative effect on the society as a whole. This ought to be fairly obvious, but just to put it in numerical terms so you can understand it. Every single year, according to Treasury Department data compiled by Andrew Bremer is the guy that shot George Wallace. Andrew Bremer, who used to be the Undersecretary of the Treasury, compiled Treasury Department, Commerce Department, Labor Department data and found that every single year, racial discrimination in wages alone, not even getting into housing or anything else, just in terms of wage discrimination, people of color being paid less than white folks for doing the same job with the same qualifications, same education, etc., that just wage discrimination alone cost communities of color $300 billion every single year in lost wages. $300 billion every single year lost to communities of color and people of color who live in those communities as a result of being paid less than they would if they were white doing the same job with the same qualifications and education. Now again, just like $10 trillion is a big number, $300 billion, not as big, but it's still big. Let me tell you how big that is, to put it in perspective, as to how much is being lost every year to communities of color desperately in need of that money and those resources. It's $300 billion is so much that if you had spent $400,000 a day, $400,000 is a lot of money too, but certainly you could spend $400,000 a day, you're pretty well off. If you had spent $400,000 every day since Jesus was born, you wouldn't have spent $300 billion. Let me repeat that. $300 billion lost every single year to communities of color because of wage discrimination. That is so much that even if you had spent $400,000 every single day, every day, since Christ was born, you would not have spent $300 billion. And that is lost every single year to communities of color. Now, do you think that that only has an impact on those communities? Do you think that the only people who are hurt by that $300 billion in lost income and lost capital and lost wealth are the black and brown people, are the Asian and Native American people that are hurt directly by it, Latinos and other persons of color? Do you think that they're the only ones? I mean, last time I checked, people of color spend a little money in the white economy, right? They spend money in with white companies as well. So that's money that is lost, that is not there to be reinvested in those communities, that is lost forever, so that those communities do not have the capital and the wealth to create businesses the way that they should, that do not have the capital and the wealth to provide for the child care and the health care in their own communities. And how ironic that at the very time that we lecture people of color about self-help, which we do, right? We say, we don't mind if you want to help yourselves, we just don't want government to do anything for you. Fine, end wage discrimination, and government won't have to do a thing for anybody in those communities, because that gap would be closed to such a degree that people of color would then be able to do completely for themselves. But right now, to the extent that companies get away with discrimination in the wage market, that is the equivalent of reverse Robin Hood. It is taking from those persons who otherwise would have earned $300 billion more and keeping the money in the hands of those who own the companies that don't pay the money out in wages. Yeah. Right? You understand? So that is a transfer policy from the have-nots to the haves. That is, people who have keeping the money for themselves and doing what they want with it instead of paying it out even though it has been earned, right? So in other words, if that were eliminated, if we actually had enforcement of civil rights law that could prevent that kind of wage bias, those communities of color would have $300 billion more a year, more than the current defense budget of the United States government, to spend in their own communities. They would be able to build their own hospitals, to build their own schools, to build their own businesses, and to say to hell with the rest of the society if they didn't want to contribute and do their part. But they can't do that now, and it's not because of a lack of effort, and it's not because of a lack of ambition, and it's certainly not because of defective DNA or cultural family patterns. It is because of this massive outflow of resources that otherwise has been earned but is not paid, and people get away with it. And according to the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, currently approximately 75% of American businesses, according to their most recent survey, are in massive violation of civil rights law. Not affirmative action law, that goes without saying. They are in violation of the Civil Rights Act itself. But unfortunately, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance only has enough money to check up on a few thousand companies at a time, right? And that's how they then make the projections. They do as much of a cross-section of companies as they can. But if you actually were to try and check up on every company, it would take 42 years with the money that the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs have to actually investigate and see if companies are discriminating. Now, that's no enforcement at all. That's no deterrence at all. And so the reality is that on a practical level, that $300 billion that's being lost ends up costing the entire society. That's money that's not available for business creation, that's not available for healthcare, that's not available for education in those communities. And then we get upset when we have to actually have government funding those programs and those policies that we think are, what, redistributive, taking my money and giving it to someone else. I mean, this ain't your money, it's the money that was earned by the people working, and they didn't get it. You don't have to pay a dime of what's yours, but they should get a dime of what's theirs. Right? That's the issue. And so I would suggest to you that we start thinking of it in those terms, that in fact currently there's a redistribution, and it's a redistribution upward that needs to be reversed. So what do you do then? I would suggest that a couple things you should do. I mentioned this earlier today in the workshop, and I'll mention it again. For those who want to know how to organize on your own campus, for example, and in your own community around issues of racial equity, gender equity, or any issues at all, whether it's environmental issues, whether it is exploitation of farm labor, whether it is gay and lesbian rights issues, whether it is anything else, anti-militarism issues, whatever it is, there are organizations out there that are more than capable of coming onto the campus and working with you, teaching you the various steps that you'll need to build coalitions and to get active on these very things, to put pressure on the administration to live up to its so-called commitment to diversity and equity, to put pressure on city officials if there are issues touching on some of these things that take place in Eugene. I'm not familiar with the city that much, so I don't know. But if there are groups that do that. Two of the groups in particular are the Center for Campus Organizing, which which is actually based in Boston, Mass., and the Western State Center, which is based out of Portland. And both of those organizations are capable of coming on, and they do this full time, this is their job, coming onto campuses like this, working with student organizers, faculty and staff persons and community folks to teach them how to essentially take control of coalition politics on their campus and to really build a movement with regard to whatever issue that's happening around the country now with regard to sweatshop labor. It's happening around, which would certainly be, you know, a fairly legitimate issue to bring up, considering that we talked about Phil Knight earlier and his, you know, ties to the university. It might be a valid issue to bring up. That's going on right now all around the country with regard to affirmative action issues. And groups like the Center for Campus Organizing, they have a website, the Western State Center, can be reached in the Portland phone book. Those organizations are capable of coming in, and I would highly recommend that you talk to some of those folks and get some of their materials so that you can begin to address some of these issues on your campus. The second thing is that for white folks in particular, since my speech is obviously directed first and foremost at other white folks, to try and light a fire under you to recognize your obligations, both morally and practically, to deal with these issues, is that we should start organizing intra-racially. Right? What I mean by that is white folks need to begin working as white folks and with other white folks on issues of racism, and not necessarily waiting around for the kumbaya moment, you know, which is what we do typically. We wait around for the ability to do the interracial, and the interracial stuff is fine, and the multiracial organizing is certainly necessary, but 82% of all white Americans live in communities that are less than 3% people of color. So if that's the case, if we're waiting around for the interracial opportunity before we start doing anti-racism work, most of us are going to be waiting until we die. Right? So the reality is that we need to get active where we are. And if we're in a largely white community or on a largely white campus, that is not an excuse not to deal with these issues. In fact, I would argue that just as people of color need to get together in their separate groups and also collectively as people of color to organize for their interests and for their concerns and to help themselves on a campus like this, so you have a Black Student Union, you have an Asian Pacific American Student Union, you have METCHA, you have these organizations. White folks need to also have an organization, but not one that's rooted in supremacy. Not one that's rooted in a white student union to defend the interest of white people. Because the interest of white, you know, the white student union is like, that's where I'm standing right now. You know, the National Association for the Advancement of White People, you know, is the administration, is the Congress, is the Fortune 500. You don't need another one, you know, in the office down in the student center. What you need is a white institution, white organization that's specifically anti-racist and dedicated to working as allies with people of color. And you can do that, and there are models for doing that. I'm starting an organization that hopefully will be up and running by the fall called the Association for White Anti-Racist Education. The acronym is AWARE. The purpose of AWARE is to provide white activists on campuses and in communities around the country with the materials that they will need to talk to other white people about these issues. The biggest thing that prevents us from doing this work a lot of times is the fear of confronting other white folks, our family, our friends, people that we work with, because we're afraid they're not going to understand, why do we care about this? I run up against this a lot, and I'm sure many of you have. And we need to learn a language and a way to communicate some of these issues and to tell the truth about these issues and to be honest and forthright and learn how to organize other white people around issues of race. So the organization I'm starting to try and do that, I have information for those who want that as far as how to get in touch with me and how to stay in touch and become one of those contacts either on this campus or in this community as a whole once the organization is up. And I think it's important to try and forge your own intra-racial efforts. The third thing you have to do, and more important than anything perhaps, is refuse to collaborate. When you are aware of an injustice, the first and foremost thing you must do and keep in your mind is that you have only two choices when confronted with injustice of any kind, not just with race issues, but with regard to anything. The first choice is to resist that injustice, and the second choice is, in effect, to collaborate with it. And between resistance and collaboration, there is not much middle ground. In fact, I would argue there is almost none most of the time. That is why that when you're made aware of ongoing inequity, when you're made aware of the pernicious use of tracking in the public schools that is racially inequitable, or housing discrimination, or wage discrimination, it's incumbent upon you to get active, where, as I said before, you become complicit in the maintenance of that inequity. And so, for example, if there are candidates running for office, whether they're local, whether they're statewide, whether they are national candidates for office as high as the president, that are not willing to make racial equity a primary agenda item for themselves, that are not willing to commit themselves to racial equity and the elimination of institutional bias, you should withhold your support from those candidates. If this is important, you do not collaborate with those persons who say things like, well, you know, I know he has a bad race record, but he's good on the environment, or he's good on women's issues. Because that's just nonsense. Anybody that doesn't have a good record of fighting institutional racism is not really an ally for women's rights, is not really an ally for the environment or labor rights. Ultimately, these things come in a package, and it's very hard for me to believe that anybody that's committed to ending institutional racism has a good record on the minimum wage for any length of time, you know, or that has a good record on labor rights or environmental organizing. You should withhold your support from candidates that are not willing to make this a significant issue. Secondly, you should withdraw your support and your money from institutions that treat people unequally in your face. And you will see it if you open your eyes and look around for it. When you see people of color being treated differently in department stores and in malls and walking down the street and going into banks, you should then proceed to withdraw your money and support and let those folks know at those banks if you know that there's unequal lending, and if you don't know, you should investigate. You should ask for their Community Reinvestment Act records. It's all public record as to what their lending policies are. You can ask for that material, work with organizations that ask for that material, and if they are not doing a good enough job of making those loans to communities of color and to low and moderate income communities generally, you take your money out of that bank. You don't just do it quietly, right? You do it collectively as part of the movement. I'm not asking for personal boycotts, because personal boycotts don't get you anything but a warm, fuzzy feeling in your heart, right? You need collective boycotts, collective action. That's the kind of thing that the Center for Community Organizing and Campus Organizing and Western State Center can both help you do. And finally, is that you have to learn to listen and to trust people of color when they tell you that certain things are happening. So when somebody tells you, I do not feel comfortable on this campus, I feel that I'm being watched in an extra special way by security, I feel like I'm being followed, I feel like I'm being, you know, given the shrift, the short shrift in the classes, I feel like I'm being treated inequitably in the larger community of Eugene, don't assume for a second, don't start off with the assumption that people are making a mountain out of a molehill. Assume for the sake of argument that folks know their reality better than you know their reality. And be willing to listen to what people of color say about racism. It doesn't mean that every time a person of color says that a certain racist thing happened, that they necessarily have it right. I'm not saying that every single time the person is correct about what did or did not happen. But let's, you know, you have to assume one or the other. Let's start off with the presumption that folks know what's happening to them. Let's start off, and even just this simple mindset change will have an effect on the way that you interact with people of color. It will reduce some of that defensiveness if you're willing to sort of compel yourself to take people seriously until they're proven wrong, instead of assuming they're wrong until they can prove they're right to you, you know? Because folks of color don't have time to prove to white people that racism still exists, you know? And it shouldn't be people of color's job to prove to white people that racism still exists. The evidence is fairly clear for anyone who's willing to look at it. And so let me just leave you with the words of James Baldwin, who I make a habit of quoting at every speech, because I think it's highly relevant to the moral obligation that we have as white folks, but as Americans in a society where racism has been so prevalent. He said something that I think speaks to this issue of collaboration, and this was in The Evidence of Things Not Seen, one of the last books that he wrote, actually, before he died. What he said was, is that the author of a crime or injustice knows it. He can make no more demands, nor is anything more demanded of him. But he who collaborates with an injustice or crime is doomed, bound forever in that unimaginable and yet all too common condition that we weakly refer to as hell. And in that place, and every American walking around should know it, one can never again summon the breath to cry, let my people go. In other words, when you capitulate to injustice once, see, Baldwin was very flowery with his words, so let me just break it down, make it easy. When you capitulate to injustice once, you will do it again, and you will do it again, and you will do it again. And pretty soon, you will not have the strength or the vitality to ever stand up to injustice, because after 10, 15, 20, 30 years of collaborating and not standing up, for you to then stand up would require you to look yourself in the mirror and admit that you didn't do it 10 and 15 and 20 years ago, and that is something you won't want to face when you're 40 and 50 years old. So I'm suggesting to you, particularly those of you who are young and in college right now, and everyone in here is certainly young and vital enough to be considered young in this regard, but particularly for those of you who are students, you have got a significant amount of time, if you're lucky, you know, God forbid, that something happens to you, but assuming that you live a long and happy and natural life in terms of longevity, you've got a lot of time to make a difference, but the longer you wait to do it, and the longer you wait to get active, speaking out and doing something about the issues that matter to you, and they may not be the exact same issues that get me up in the morning, but whatever it is, if you don't do it now, I assure you, 10 and 20 years from now, when you're sweating a mortgage, and when you're sweating those loan repayments, which, believe me, will take 10 or 15 years to repay in some instances, and when you're worried about raising that family, and when you're worried about putting food on the table, and you're worried about all kinds of other things that folks have to worry about, if you didn't get active before and sort of get yourself attuned to making this part of your everyday life, you'll never do it at 40 and 50 years old. You will never jump on that bandwagon later. You might, but very few people will. And so I'm suggesting to you, make it easy on yourself. Start now and pace yourself and stay active. And recognize that you will probably never see that thing called justice in the final sense, because it's not a thing. It's not a finish line that we just cross one day and then we can all go and play in the park because we got justice now. And I've had these workshops where people say that. They say, you know, I can't wait. I'm going to do anti-racism work for like 10 years, and then I can just retire and go open a restaurant because we'll have solved the problem. You know, there are people who feel that way. Look, the struggle is never over. And even if there was a thing called justice and we got it next week, you know what? The week after that, we'd have to start another fight to keep what we had. So the reality is the battle never ends. It's about setting an example for your children and for your grandchildren and for all the generations that will come after you, because maybe they will ultimately achieve justice, but maybe they won't. And it's not the point. You see, the point is not the victory. The point is standing up and being able to look at yourself in the mirror 20 and 30 years from now and know that you did not collaborate with injustice, that you did not collaborate with inequity, that you did not close your eyes and act like it didn't affect you and live 70, 75 years, work for a company you didn't even like, make not nearly enough money to be as happy as you thought you wanted to be. You go on vacation once a year for 2 weeks, you get a sunburn or whatever, you come back, and then you retire, and then you die. You know, I mean, that surely can't be what life is about. I mean, I don't know, you know, I'm only 30, and I don't know what the meaning of life is, but I know it ain't that. You know, I hope that it ain't that. You know, I think it's a good night's sleep. I think that's the meaning of life. And what I mean by that is that when you know that you've done everything you can do, and when you know that you've lived a life of integrity, you can sleep well at night. And sleeping well at night sometimes is all it takes to get you through. And I appreciate your attention, and I'll take any questions that you have at this time. So I got a lot to get out for the fall, because I won't be talking, you know, for like 4 months. I'm like a monk. I don't speak. So I'm done, and I just had to get all that out. I appreciate you sticking with it. Yes?
And we talked earlier about affirmative action. And you mentioned, too, about the way anti-affirmative action laws are sweeping through California and Washington.
Yeah.
What do you think the implications would be, particularly on the state of Oregon, with particularly how it applies to higher education?
Well, I mean, there are two possible things that could happen. I mean, one is, and this is actually from a legal perspective, you know, the University of Washington is being sued right now, or law school is being sued, for so-called reverse discrimination. And if anybody's interested in getting into the facts of that case, I will, if you want to ask me a question. I don't want to belabor the issue right now. They're being sued. If the woman who is suing the UW wins that suit, there's no question that it will affect the entire circuit that's affected by that decision, which will be, you know, a handful of states, including Oregon, obviously. And so there's the potential that that decision, much like the Hopwood decision with the University of Texas, would affect the ability of schools like this one to administer affirmative action programs in any real demonstrative, aggressive way. It's already happened in Texas. It's certainly happened in California with 209 and with the decision of the Board of Regents. So that's number one. I mean, that could happen. But even if Keturah Smith, the main plaintiff in this lawsuit, were to lose, which is a possibility for sure, the reality is that already the UW has started to retrench on their affirmative action program. They've already started to cut back many of the things they were doing. And of course, I-200 has now forced them to cut back even more. And I think they've actually cut more than I-200 required them to cut, but that's a different story. The point is that just the climate that's been created is very dangerous, because it means that schools like this one could easily say, we don't want to wait around until we get sued. Let's just go ahead and dump these programs now, you know, or let's really alter the programs and minimize them now before we get in trouble, you know. And so that's a real possibility, and I don't know. Of course, the other possibility, like I said, that could also be turned around, and if Oregon is really committed, if OSU is really committed, if schools here, public institutions, and even private institutions in the state of Oregon were really committed to diversity the way they say, they should be, you know, quote-unquote cherry-picking the people that are being, you know, left out in those other states, taking those people who are good, competent, qualified students, capable, and hardworking students who are saying, you know, I don't want to go to UW. I don't feel comfortable now. I don't want to go to Berkeley because it's clear they don't want me. There are actually dozens of students, hundreds of students, and some of them are being recruited by East Coast schools. You know, they're being recruited by Midwestern schools. They're being recruited by schools in my part of the country. My guess is a lot of them would rather stay a little closer to home and would be more than happy to come to schools in Oregon. But that recruitment obviously is not taking advantage of it. So the result could go either way. I mean, if the administrations of the various schools in Oregon were really committed, they could say, this is a great opportunity for us to take advantage of these horrible things, unfortunately, that have happened in these other two states. But I'm afraid that the likely response, at least initially, is going to be the opposite, that it's going to be a retrenchment and say, ooh, we've been lucky. So far, we haven't been sued. We better watch it. You know, we better not do anything too aggressive. And I'm afraid that's the likely result. But again, that's going to be very much up to you. I mean, it will be very much up to students and whether or not you were mobilized to prevent that kind of retrenchment. And if, in fact, the Ward Connerlys of the world begin to launch a similar initiative here in Oregon, which they've talked about, and there's been legislation introduced in the House here in Oregon a couple of years in a row, and it's never gone anywhere, thank God, but it could. And unless people are mobilized and prepared to organize against that, if it comes to Oregon either as a voter initiative or as a bill, then eventually, of course, it will pass. I mean, I'm sure they see Oregon as an easy state, you know, to get, because there are far fewer people of color here than there would be, let's say, in Florida, where they've announced they're going next, right? That's their next state they're trying to get is Florida. I think they're going to have a very hard time in Florida, and when they have a hard time in Florida, they'll probably come back and say, well, we couldn't get Florida, too many black and Latino folks, and let's go back and get Idaho and Oregon, you know? And so it could be coming here within a year, you know? And I think it's important to be prepared for that, to be learning about these issues, to be getting in touch with groups like CCO in Western states and finding out how to organize in a proactive way instead of a reactive way. Be prepared when those folks come here to try and change the policies of this university or the state.
Unfortunately, I missed your talk earlier about affirmative action. I have a white male friend who is a pilot, and he feels that he is struggling in, and this was a couple years ago, struggling to be considered for positions because other minorities are getting jobs with lesser qualifications.
As a pilot?
As a pilot. Okay. Well, with less hours logged.
Interesting. The number of pilots who are of color in the United States is approximately 1.9. So he must either be very unlucky in the sense that he just happens to have been in a competition with every one of the handful of pilots of color, or he's wrong. And I would suggest that he's wrong. Now, is it easy to tell somebody they're wrong? Of course it's not. People believe that that's happened, and you know what? In some cases, it does.
Right.
In some cases, it's true. But for a pilot to say he's having a hard time finding work because he's a white guy, when 97%, 98% or whatever, almost 99% of the pilots are white, and 94% I think are men, is pretty preposterous. And so I doubt very seriously that now, if in fact he has evidence.
Well, he did get the job,
okay.
But he is working with other pilots. I mean, it wasn't easy, but working with other pilots that are getting hired with very little log hours as far as in the overall spectrum, it's a attitude. It's like, okay, this person who doesn't speak English as
right.
well as some people.
Yeah, you know, they fly planes in other parts of the world.
Right.
That's
exactly.
The interesting thing.
You know, what I want to be able to do is, you know, looking at different jobs like that, I want to be able to have something to say other than the growth statistics.
I think the questions you have to ask people, and I always ask these questions because I'm not suggesting that it's never true. For example, when I was on the radio a lot in Seattle before the vote on 200, guys would call in and say, now, I didn't get this job, or I saw, you know, this person was incompetent. And, you know, are there incompetent black people? Of course. Are there incompetent Latinos and Asians and Native people? Of course. Are there incompetent women? Yes. And what affirmative action does is it allows incompetent people of color to have just as much opportunity as incompetent white guys have always had. And I say that somewhat flippantly. I say that somewhat flippantly, but it's true. The reality is, the old way of things, there were plenty of incompetent white guys, and no one ever thought to say, you know, I was working with this white guy and didn't know how to do the job, and it must be because he was white. But when you have a person of color who fails on the job or doesn't do as well, we automatically want to attribute it to the fact that they are a person of color or the fact that they are a woman, instead of the fact that as an individual, they may or may not have been the most competent person. But there have been white people and still are getting hired as pilots, as whatever else, who are not necessarily all that competent. And particularly with regard to language skills, I mean, the reality is there are plenty of fantastic pilots who don't speak English, if for no other reason, and many that they don't live in an English-speaking country. They fly planes and land them and take them off safely and don't crash them every day, because ultimately you don't have to speak a particular language to be able to fly a plane. Now, I guess I would ask a question, the way that I ask questions to people that call. I ask them if they say that they've been the victim of reverse discrimination, because I don't want to assume that they're just lying or wrong. Because, I want to assume that they know their reality better than I do. So I asked them, okay, fine, you know, who told you, for example, that you couldn't have this job or that you couldn't have this contract or whatever? I get that a lot. They told me I couldn't get a contract because I was a white guy. Who told you? Well, I don't know, somebody at the department there that I was applying. Well, who was it? What department? You know, it was a long time ago. I can't really remember. And I'm not exaggerating. This happens like 95% of the time. Nine times out of ten, at least. People, when I ask them these questions, who told you? When did it happen? And when they actually come up with that information and say, well, you know, it happened, these people told me that, you know what I've told them? I said, you know, you should get a lawyer. because you've been the victim of discrimination, and it was wrong, and it shouldn't have been done. And that's not what affirmative action requires. Affirmative action does not require. In fact, affirmative action policies explicitly prohibit the use of forced and rigid quotas, except in those instances where a particular firm or a particular industry has been found repeatedly to violate the law. AT&T, for example, was subject in the early part of the 70s to a quota hiring plan because they admitted in open court that they had discriminated massively for years against African American women. Color. So the court said, for the next so many years, you're going to have to hire X number of people of color to rectify what you acknowledge has been this vicious system of inequity. But unless there's that proof in court, unless you basically acknowledge it in a consent decree, there are no hard and fast quotas. So the idea that somehow people are just being hired because they're black, or because they're Latino, or because they're women, flies in the face of the way affirmative action actually works, and certainly with regard to piloting. I guess the question I would ask him is, do you really believe that the company you work for, whether it's a commercial airline, whether it's a charter airline company or whatever else, would hire somebody who was not capable of flying a plane, putting themselves at extreme financial risk in the case of an accident, all for the sake of being politically correct? I mean, do we really think that companies would go, you know, to hell with profits, to hell with public perception, to hell with the insurance rates, you know, let's just go get some black people? Because the thing I always find interesting is, if that were true, if companies...